This is the Takeaway Podcast for Monday, August 10th, 2015. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The urgency of opera, that passage from the very sober and stormy Mozart Requiem, puts us all on alert. Opera does that. Plays on our emotions and our sense of drama. Later this hour, how the drama and urgency of opera as an art form has inspired all kinds of technological innovations that may just shock some of you with an opera allergy to give it a fresh look. The urgency of Mozart is also just a way to begin conversations about the crisis for Europe, facing waves of migrants from the Middle East, and how the urgent bargaining is going down to the wire on a global climate change agreement months from the Paris summit in December. We begin in the warm waters of the Mediterranean, where the United Nations says the number of refugees arriving by boat to the various Greek islands has soared 750% since this time last year. 50,000 migrants, mainly from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, arrived in July alone. Coping with a huge share of refugees to southern Europe is another burden for Greece, already choked by creditor-imposed austerity. William Spindler is spokesperson from the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, and he says once again, Europe cannot resolve its differences despite the human cost.
We are seeing the largest number of arrivals by sea, basically since we started counting. Last year, we had some 219,000 people arriving during the whole of 2014. We have passed that figure in the first 7 months of 2015. So this is very worrying. It's a symptom of the conflicts going on in the Middle East and parts of Africa that are pushing literally millions of people to leave their homes. We are particularly concerned about the situation in Greece, which has received so far a large number of refugees from Syria who are arriving in very difficult conditions. There are many people with war wounds. There are disabled people. There are pregnant women, small children, many families with children. Syrian refugees are about 70% of those arriving in Greece. But there are also refugees from other countries such as Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, and so on.
What is the passage like for these various individuals? We've certainly seen enormous amount of death and heartbreak in the trafficking of refugees from North Africa to Southern Europe.
Well, almost without exception, all these vessels are terribly overcrowded and many of them are unseaworthy. Some of them are fishing boats that are not equipped to carry people, and then literally hundreds of people are crammed into them in terrible conditions. They are packed basically shoulder to shoulder in some cases. The smugglers who organized all these trips charge them a lot of money for that. They are risking their lives. They seldom wear life vests. So these are not very safe conditions, and as a result, we have seen a large number of casualties. So far, we have counted about 2,000 people dead or reported missing in the Mediterranean.
The United Nations, of course, is one model for world governance, and you work for the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. The Eurozone is another regional governance model. We've seen the financial difficulties of the Eurozone attempting to reconcile the very stark financial differences between Germany and Greece. Does Europe handle a crisis like this migrant crisis in a uniform way, or is it a government-to-government situation, which, of course, increases the hardship in a place like Greece, which has terrible financial problems already?
Well, the problem is that this has become a crisis not because of the numbers of people involved, but because of the failure of Europe to deal with it in a coordinated manner. As you were just saying, many of these countries in Europe are responding unilaterally. Instead of working together, they seem to just be, you know, blaming each other and pointing fingers at each other, and that's not helpful. Europe as a whole has the means, the capacity, the resources to deal with this crisis. But obviously, small communities, because at the end of the day, that's what they are. Small communities in Greece or in southern Italy do not have those resources. So it's these communities that are being left to fend for themselves, to deal with this large influx of people. And these communities are ill-equipped to respond to that challenge because they don't have the resources, they don't have the means to do that.
Forgive my personal frustration, but once again, we're seeing that this Eurozone commonality is again, something of a joke when it comes to dealing with pragmatic matters that involve actual human misery. Now, I don't want to draw you into some, insult match against Europe and the Eurozone, but this is really an outrageous demonstration that they do not have their act together.
Well, it seems that they are not really waking up to the reality of what is happening at their doorstep. And we would like to see a much more coordinated response. We think that in the case of Greece, it's the government of Greece that has the primary responsibility to respond to the situation. And they should be taking the lead and coming up with a plan and to appoint an entity or a person that coordinated that response. And that would be much more easier for organizations such as us, for international aid organizations, but also for the European Union to help them. But of course, Greece is going through an economic crisis, and they might not have the necessary resources. But it's not just a question of resources. It's a question of leadership, of vision, of assuming responsibility. And many countries in Europe don't seem to be taking that responsibility. They just hope that somebody else will take care of the problem. And the situation, which has been going on for years, is getting worse and worse by the day.
William Spindler is Senior Communications Officer for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Speaking of somebody else, what European governments lack the will to do, one American millionaire with a boat is apparently trying to do single-handedly. Christopher Catrambone from Lake Charles, Louisiana, has set up the Migrant Offshore Aid Station, or MOAS for short. His boat, the Phoenix, has been rescuing hundreds, if not thousands, crossing the Mediterranean at a personal cost of $8 million. To shame European governments into taking more people in.
What we've done here is really venture philanthropy because we've taken risk. We went into a different area to prove a concept. Of course, we're not going to really find any EU government that just jumps over the fence and decides that a private initiative is better than a state initiative.
Christopher Catrambone is the subject of a new Vice News special on the migrant crisis in the Mediterranean called The Smartest Man in the Sea. Simon Ostrowski is a Vice News correspondent. Welcome, Simon.
Hi there.
What's your role in this documentary?
Well, I was the reporter. It was produced by Claire Ward, and MOAS invited us to have a look at their operation before they headed out on their first mission earlier this summer. And I think it's quite unique because what it is an organization created by private individuals doing the work that you would expect a government or a nation state to be doing, you know, coast guards, navies, but definitely not a guy from Louisiana who bought a boat in Virginia, outfitted it, took it across the Atlantic, put a team together, and now literally cruises the Mediterranean looking for boats to rescue.
What's he say is his motivation here?
Well, you know, their slogan is no one should die at sea. And that's basically what they say their motivation is. And that's what they're doing is picking people up out of the sea. And I can't say that they're the only people doing it.
Right.
But they played, I think, a pretty important role earlier this summer in getting the European Union to get its act together by drawing a lot of attention to the migrant crisis, because European leaders are stuck between two very difficult decisions. They have to either make their constituencies displeased that they're helping bring more illegal migration into Europe, or they have to be blamed for the deaths at sea. And now we've had over 2,000 of them this year alone. And I think they've decided that the second is worse than the first. And so they've committed quite a few resources now to patrolling the Mediterranean, and not just the Mediterranean, but in the places you need to patrol to be able to rescue these boats, because they basically run out of fuel or go adrift pretty close to the Libyan coast. And border protection only skirts the European coast. And so when they were doing that, a lot of people were going under.
Why do you call Christopher Catrambone the smartest man in the sea when he seems a little bit like a Don Quixote character as well?
Well, you know, in one of the interviews we were doing with him, he was referring to himself as the smartest man in the room because he's quite a successful insurance provider. In fact, he made his money servicing insurance providers during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to companies that contracted to the United States government. I think the whole arc, his, you know, narrative arc is pretty interesting because if you think about it, you know, the instability that caused this migrant crisis leads all the way back to the American invasion of Iraq. This is a person who essentially made his name during, I'm not, you know, blaming him for the Iraq war, obviously, but he's a person who made his career and his name during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Now
as an insurance provider,
as well as a service provider to insurance mm-hmm. companies. So insurance companies would go around hiring local people, which American insurance companies didn't want to provide insurance to. And he
so this
stepped
is a
in.
Give back. This is a give back in a sense.
Well, he didn't like that parallel when I made it
really,
in one
really,
of
really.
His interviews. And he was very adamant about saying, I'm not a contractor. You know, but he is a person who did business with contractors in Iraq, and that's true. And so now, you know, 10, how many years are we down the line? 12 years down mm-hmm. the line, 14. He's picking up, sort of the consequences of that in the middle of the Mediterranean.
And, you know, the whole role of the NGOs and these kinds of individuals, he's working with Doctors Without Borders, has really, as you say, signaled European governments to look at this differently. Here's Joseph Muscat, who's Prime Minister of Malta.
Look, I think that what private individuals do in order to give a signal is very important. But I, for one, think that states should not abdicate their responsibilities on this issue, definitely.
Can he and others move Europe to make a more coordinated effort here? What did you think?
Well, listen, when we did that interview that we just heard a clip from, that was a year after the Prime Minister of Malta made a complete about-face because he came to power originally promising to stop immigration. The Maltese were very unhappy with the number of migrants that have been coming in for years now. I think now he's warmed up to MOAS and to the idea that people need to be rescued at sea. And he's making these, you know, very nice sound bites to us and to others about, you know, the humanitarian crisis that is at foot. So if he could make that change, then I think other European Union leaders can make that change too and need to make that change. And I think what we need, at least what the aid workers are urging the Europeans to do at this point, is to keep up what they're doing and not let up the pressure on making sure there are boats out there.
Fascinating look at the migrant crisis in the Mediterranean. Simon Ostrovsky is a Vice News correspondent. His documentary special on the crisis is called The Smartest Man in the Sea. Thanks so much, Simon.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Running out of time, that's the word. 10 days are all that's left, in fact, say the worried diplomats trying to forge a meaningful climate change agreement in time for the Paris conference later this year. That's not the deadline for some massive glacial melt that will flood Paris or something. Given the complexity of environmental agreements, 10 days are all that's left to work on the main provisions in human time so that individual governments can translate them all into the actual language of a global agreement. The hard dealing takes place right now to prepare for world leaders convening in Paris in December. In an interview with the Associated Press, UN Climate Chief Cristiana Figueres said this conference may be the last chance to address this issue and save the planet. Speaking to the AP, she said, quote, "We do not play with this anymore. We are at 5 minutes to midnight, and Paris is the 12 o'clock strike." We turn now to someone familiar with the pace of diplomatic time, geologic time, and the urgency of climate effects already being seen from global warming. Carol Browner, senior counselor at the Albright Stonebridge Group, a strategy and business advisory firm. She's former advisor for energy and climate change for the Obama administration and EPA administrator under President Bill Clinton.
The goal of this conference in December in Paris will be for each country to bring what is called an intended nationally determined contribution. In other words, what are their plans for how they will reduce their greenhouse gas pollution? And countries are already putting those on the table. So a lot of negotiations around what those are, what other countries will be doing, and then ultimately how those commitments will be verified, the transparency in terms of reporting and monitoring. So lots going on.
And so does each country deliver its verification plan, its target for meeting various kinds of climate change emission standards, that sort of thing, and then it's added up in Paris, and if it meets the global target, then we either look at it again, or are all those things taking place right now that it has to add up before, long before we get to Paris?
Well, the hope is it will add up before we get to Paris, because countries are going ahead and announcing their plans. In fact, President Obama just announced another piece of his plan last week, requiring power plants that burn fossil fuels to reduce their carbon pollution. Each of the 50 states will be writing a plan. Brazil has announced commitments. China has announced commitments. So I think the hope is that it does add up. There's a big difference this year. These conferences happen every year. And the difference this year is, rather than sort of a top-down plan being imposed, sort of a one-size-fits-all for the world, individual countries are looking at what's best in their history, what's best in terms of their type of pollution, in terms of their economic growth. And so we're going to see lots of different tools being used. But you're exactly right. The hope is that they add up and that we are able to achieve what the scientists tell us, which is significant reductions.
So the stumbling blocks in Paris may be a question among the big emitters of whether the individual plans are enough or reflect a fairness. There was always the conflict between China and the United States regarding its attempt to build into an industrial nation and not be constrained by environmental plans that the U.S. wasn't constrained by during the 1800s. I'm wondering if that's going to be the same kind of stumbling block this time. And what about the nations that have to worry about global warming and ocean level rise immediately? What can they expect from the international community? Is that going to be part of this deal?
Yes, I think that the big points of contention in Paris will be, first of all, what are the nature of these individual country plans, and are they enforceable? Can a country really ensure the actions will be taken? Is it transparent? Can you measure the progress? Is there monitoring? Is there reporting? So all of that will be important, because you can make a plan, but if you don't implement a plan, it won't mean anything. Then the second issue, to your point, is what are we going to do for those parts of the world where resources are an issue? Is there going to be some sort of financing available? Will there be some opportunities, not only for governments? Obviously, there's an obligation for governments to step forward, and particularly for the developed world to step forward, but also for businesses, perhaps, to come forward and to participate in plans in developing countries that reduce emissions. And so I think a lot of the focus in Paris will be on that financing, and will be on sort of the transparency verification of the individual country plans.
Carol Browner, you had a mixed experience at the Environmental Protection Agency under Bill Clinton. It's a frustrating place to be. You're really under the gun at the EPA. But I'm wondering how you would assess the belief that the EPA is going to have to get a lot stronger as an agency, much, much stronger, if the Obama administration's plans are going to be realized.
Well, I think it's important to remember, whether it's, you know, under Bill Clinton or President Obama, the EPA is not free to do whatever it wants. Even if the science dictates something, EPA has to follow the law. And so you saw under President Obama last week, he used the existing Clean Air Act passed by Congress in 1990 to require very significant reductions in carbon pollution on a state-by-state basis. And I think that what the important test of any EPA is, are they taking the laws on the books and using them to maximum extent so that we can achieve, you know, less carbon pollution, cleaner air and cleaner water. And I think that I'm proud of my record at EPA, and I think that President Obama has a really good record unfolding.
Carol Browner, senior counselor at the Albright Stonebridge Group, a strategy and business advisory firm, former advisor for energy and climate change for President Obama, and EPA administrator under Bill Clinton. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
The nuclear deal is done with Iran, but the dealing is not. Prominent Democrats are skeptical. New York's Chuck Schumer says he will vote against it. And there's a TV ad campaign in 23 states aimed at pressuring other lawmakers to vote against the agreement. Citizens for a Nuclear-Free Iran, created by the powerful American-Israel Public Affairs Committee.
The Iran nuclear deal. Good deal or bad deal? Iran keeps their nuclear facilities. Military sites can go uninspected. Restrictions end after 10 years. Then Iran could build a nuclear weapon in 2 months.
Iran. On Saturday, the White House gained the support of 29 leading scientists, Nobel Prize winners, and nuclear experts who signed an open letter to President Obama praising the agreement. It makes the world safer, say these scientists. Dr. Robert Goldston is a professor of astrophysical sciences at Princeton University and a signatory of the letter.
We think this is a very good deal when you look at it from the point of view of nonproliferation.
And scientifically speaking, that's because of the agreement itself, or just that something has to be done to deal with Iran, that Iran needs to be brought into the international community. What are you focusing on?
Well, if you look at this in the context of other nonproliferation agreements, you look at it in the context of the nonproliferation treaty or even its additional protocol, this goes way beyond things that have been done before. This is a very powerful and effective agreement. There's new ideas in it. There's a lot of restrictions. There's very good verification. Some of the things that I've been pushing for years are right there.
And it's not a perfect agreement. You wouldn't say that, yes?
Well, is there ever a perfect agreement? But it's between two. It's between actually, I guess, seven sovereign countries. And so everybody doesn't get everything they want. But in terms of the list of things you might want, this thing, you tick them right off and they're there.
And so would you describe the initiative by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee as a campaign against the agreement that will have the net effect, if it derails the agreement, of increasing the chances for proliferation?
Oh, absolutely. I'm Jewish, and amongst my people in my synagogue who are even big fans of AIPAC, they can't understand what AIPAC is doing because there's no route out. There's no let's have another negotiation. That doesn't exist.
So what would explain this? You get the impression that Iran can never be dealt with as anything other than a warmongering, isolated rogue nation, even though these negotiations have gone on for quite a long time with, as you've suggested, six other nations.
Well, I mean, Iran is a rogue, crazy state. I mean, that's a fact, and we have to deal with that. So I think it may change someday, but you can't depend on that. The key point here is that we've put them in a box for quite a long time. We've got enough time. A point that we make in this letter is that we've got enough time to change the rules for when they get out of the box to make the nonproliferation treaty stronger. And so for 15 years, we've pushed back the point we were at in 2012, which was that they were 2 or 3 weeks from a bomb, or 2 or 3 weeks from this breakout idea, something people don't understand. It's not 2 or 3 months. It was 2 or 3 weeks as of the negotiation in Geneva, which set up the interim deal. And now we've got them many, many months, sort of a year from a breakout time. And that'll be like that for a long time.
And describe specifically how this deal addresses an issue of trust that you find most alarming as an American Jew or as just a human being?
Well, there was a moment when, again, as I mentioned before the interim agreement, when they had 200 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium. That is enough. 225 would be a better number, but that's enough that if they took that away and put it under a mountain somewhere, they could very, very quickly turn that into the material you needed for a weapon. And you would never find it. So they were as close as you could imaginably be to being a nuclear-armed state. That is a very scary situation. And Netanyahu was absolutely right in 2012 when he showed that sort of cartoon bomb. What we have done is drain that bomb. So they're far, far from being able to make a weapon. And we'll be able to see it with all of these verification procedures.
Dr. Robert Goldston is professor of astrophysical sciences at Princeton University, one of 29 scientists who signed a letter to President Barack Obama expressing support for the Iran nuclear agreement. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Certainly. Thank you very much for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like networking, nutrition, and ninja training. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
What would you call sitting at home and listening to a live performance that you can't attend in person? Streaming, maybe? This is a performance of Mozart's The Magic Flute. And here is a more contemporary example from John Adams' opera, The Death of Klinghoffer. Did you know that in 1880, two inventors in the U.S. and Britain used opera as the original inspiration for electronic streaming? They ran telephone lines into their private homes to listen to opera. But then they wondered about what might fill the silence when the opera stage was dark or during intermission. And talking about the news, newscasting was born. Actually, it was just reading the newspapers into a microphone. Opera has been an inspiration for lots of technological applications for centuries. Opera itself is the original multi-platform, multimedia spectacle. Opera was a natural for the early movies. Silent flicks suddenly became talkies or singies. An opera soundtrack is synchronized with a silent movie. Here, opera singer George Mendel in 1907 is singing La Marseillaise on screen and in a recording. Opera is a living, innovating, changing artistic tradition. It's not a dead art form for snobs. Mark Shubin is media engineer and opera historian at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. He says the spirit of innovation in opera is alive and well.
Electronic home entertainment, consumer headphones, movies were all invented for opera, and things like newscasts and sportscasts weren't invented for opera, but they were created through the auspices of opera or the funding of opera, right down to modern media, digital audio, and into the future, neutrino communications and quantum entanglement are all being considered for opera.
How was opera a laboratory for special effects in the very early days?
One opera house that was built in 1766 or opened in 1766, that's 10 years before the Declaration of Independence in the United States, and it still exists today. It's called the Drottningholm Slottstheater. It's outside of Stockholm. And the stage machinery that's there is just extraordinary. They have elevators. They have ocean wave machines, thunder machines, wind machines, all kinds of stuff. And that was in the 18th century.
The early days of broadcast and the early days of electronic transmission really was devoted to figuring out ways of having more people experience opera.
Yeah. People talk about the first radio station being KDKA in Pittsburgh, but that was in 1920. And 10 years before that, operas were transmitted from the Metropolitan Opera House on radio. And 3 years before that, there was a gigantic 200-ton synthesizer that made opera music and broadcast it, and it was so early in the days of wireless transmission that it interfered with the Navy, and the Navy came to stop the opera music transmission. But then the Navy decided that opera music was actually very useful to them to test their radio facilities, and they used to do the Anvil Chorus from Il Trovatore to test the capacity of their transmitters and see if the meters would match the anvil sound.
When anyone decides, say, World Series time, to log on to the Major League Baseball site and, you know, maybe not pay for the stream of the actual game, but decides to watch that representation of the game taking place on screen, they owe a debt to opera's ability to do the very same thing generations ago on stage when people would go to games and watch the game being essentially depicted on stage.
Yeah, that's correct. Starting in 1885 at the Grand Opera House in Augusta, Georgia, and then the Grand Opera House in Nashville, people would come to the Opera House and watch live remote games. There would be a telegraph operator at the game, and he would telegraph the plays to a telegraph operator in the Opera House, and that person would read the plays, and then a third person would move some sort of indicator around on a board so people could tell where the players were and what was going on. And then both the choreography and the technology advanced very quickly. So by 1886 in Detroit, we have reports of what it was like in the Opera House, and it was like being at the ballpark. The person would say, and it's a high fly ball, and it's out to Dalrymple.
Will opera continue to maintain this innovative mode, and can it buck the notion that young people have that opera is somehow a snooty art form that doesn't, you know, work with, you know, cinema and, you know, YouTube right now?
I think so. There are major opera companies around the world, including the Metropolitan Opera, that are doing streaming, that are transmitting their operas to movie theaters. And then we have situations like a small opera company in New York called On Site Opera that last year did Rameau's Pygmalion. The titles, the translations available via Google Glass. So if you wore Google Glass, you had the translations projected into your eye, and wherever you looked and they performed all over a space, you would see the appropriate titles. Was at an opera conference in 2013 in Denmark, where there were laboratories from around the world that were talking about neutrino communications to eliminate the delay when you have, say, a singer who's performing in Beijing and a singer who's performing in San Francisco, and they're doing a duet together, even at the speed of light. That's too fast to get around the curvature of the Earth. So neutrino communications would speed that up. But maybe even that's not fast enough, and that's why there was this discussion of quantum entanglement, communications using quantum particles that are married and then brought to separate locations, and whatever you do to one happens to the other.
Brought together from separate locations, married and then separated. It sounds like an opera libretto right there, and there's something John Adams might actually write, Quantum Entanglement, the opera.
It's possible.
All right, Mark Shubin, media engineer and opera historian at the Metropolitan Opera House. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And keep innovating.
I'll try.
And here's something to take with you today. Spiders innovating. If you're having trouble going it alone, get some allies. Loner spiders have banded together this week in Dallas to freak out people, but mostly to weave a gigantic web to collectively trap insects. Thousands of spiders made a web 300 feet wide and 40 feet in height. It's a rare occurrence, and scientists believe this adapted behavior was to take advantage of giant insect hatches from a nearby lake. Give us your view on anything, including scary, creepy communal spiders at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.